This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
The River Blackwater flows through Kerry, Cork and Waterford. It rises near Slieve Lucra, or Mountain of Rushes in Kerry, and runs east through Mallow and Fermoy in Cork. The river enters Waterford and flows through Lismore, before abruptly turning south at Cappoquin, finally meeting the sea at Youghal Harbour. In the fourth part of our series, Blackwater Life and Lodgings, we continue our trip up the River Blackwater, visiting the historical houses and landmarks that inhabit its banks, examining how the river has shaped the lives of the people and families who call these banks home. The fishing vessel Maeve and her crew leave Strangcally Castle and travel upriver to Headborough House. Headborough House used to be the seat of the Smiths of Headborough, a branch of the Smith family of Ballinatrae.
Headborough was remodelled in the 1820s by Percy Smith. Now this Percy Smith was the third son of Richard Smith of Ballinatrae, and he was the actual ancestor of the Smiths then of Headborough. And when he married Catherine O'Dell of Carrigglee in 1826, they decided that they would remodel the old house that existed on the place. Now there was an old Elizabethan house that still exists, and they sort of put a front on it, which remodeled it. And then onto the very front of that again, they put a conservatory, which has been taken down. The house is, as I said, very large, and at that time in the 1820s, when people had a fair amount of money, they went to build very, very large houses. The Smiths also built Monatree House as their summer house, and it has many similarities to actually Headborough House.
In recent years, Headborough House has undergone extensive renovation by its present owners, the Skeynes. However, the house still contains an eye-catching wall covering from the 19th century.
It's actually hung with a coloured early 19th century French pictorial paper called The Dream of Happiness. Now, this was the height of fashion at the time, and the French paper was made by the Delvaux company in Paris. And they made several of these pictorial hand-blocked papers for houses, particularly in Great Britain, that were being built at the time. But this was the only one that arrived in Ireland. It was a very, very difficult process because the blocks, the timber blocks to make the paper, all had to be hand-carved and cut. And then each section of paper was printed with printing blocks and then coloured in by hand afterwards. The paper remained in the house even though it went through a period of almost dereliction, but the present owners actually have restored most of it. Headborough was sold in the 1970s to an American family, the Cornells. And the Cornells, they lived here for a long number of years, and at one stage they established a little small factory at the back of the house which manufactured electric switches, and these electrical switches then were exported to America. And then the house was sold in 1995 to another American family, the Skeynes, and the Skeynes have carried out extensive renovations to the house. The house is in very, very fine state of repair presently.
At Headborough, the River Bride flows into the Blackwater, and here the crew meet Niall O'Brien, author of Blackwater and Bride, Navigation and Trade. Starting 9,000 years ago, the book offers an insight into the emergence of the Blackwater and the Bride as major hubs of commercial activity.
At times, the Bride was as big in trade as the Blackwater, sometimes even bigger. But that's kind of relative. History is kind of depends on what documents survive, and sometimes the documents survive more for the Bride than they do for the Blackwater, and so it kind of disjointed view. But often we find out these things because of litigation of York Corporation fighting with the people of Tallow over duties and charges for using the river and charges for using Yall. And if Cap Gwyn was having a better trade than Tallow, then Yall Corporation would be fighting with Cap Gwyn for increased duty charges for all the boats that are going up and down the river and passing through Yall. They started fighting with the Tallow people, and that's how we know that the Bride was at times a better river than the Blackwater. Even up till the 19th century, when we have the Yall Harbour books in the 1870s and up till 1920s, they showed that the Bride was just as good as the Blackwater. And that has to do with personalities, really, more than anything else. You had merchants in Tallow that were go-getting, up for it. They'd trade anywhere with anything, kind of Michael O'Leary of that day. And you need personalities to get a business going. You might have the resources there, you have the river there, you have the timber, you have the farmland, but you need a personality to pull these things together, and the Tallow people seems to have a good share of those kind of go-getting people. I suppose into the 1880s, 90s that we see Cap Gwyn with the Keens developing the ironworks there, that developed a bit of business out there. But mostly it was Tallow, because Tallow had a kind of a hub. It was a kind of transport hub. It could take you to Famaille, whereas the river couldn't take it to Famaille. It only take as far as Lismore. And so the road network was better to get up into the interior, we'll call it.
From the middle of the 20th century, trade on the rivers Blackwater and Bride began to decline significantly.
Up to the 1950s, you had sailing vessels all over the place, and there was fleets of them. A couple of hundred in each port, and they could have kept going for another 10 or 20 years or more. What killed the sailing vessels was that you had craftspeople in the various ports making ropes, sails, and so forth and so on. And the volume of trade was good for repairing vessels, but it just wasn't enough to keep them in existence with the cost of living growing, and so they just went away. And when the vessels didn't were in trouble, there was no one to repair them, and the vessels were just tied up and left there. In Yall, you had the ship's graveyard, where plenty of vessels were just brought in. They had something wrong with them, there was no one to repair them, and they just left them there. So overnight, you had plenty of sailing vessels, and then it changed, and you had none. But then, of course, you had other factors. You had the growth of the motor car, you had the growth of the lorries, you had big diesel-driven vessels, you have even basic starter containers coming in, and so the big ports took over. And then of course you had the new Yall Bridge was built, a concrete bridge with no opening, so vessels couldn't get up anymore. Even Yall Port itself for a number of years, 50s and 60s and 70s, was kind of a dead end. It was only in the 80s when you had Yall Shipping started up again, and suddenly you had a bit of trade coming in again, and there's still trade coming in. It's good to see the port itself if you're all growing, but as for upriver, there won't be any trade again. Without the Bride and Blackwater rivers there, you wouldn't have the developments that we saw in the various towns, and you wouldn't have the big houses that we see up and down the river today. You have Strangcally, Ballinatray, Germanna, Turin, so forth and so on. You don't build big houses in poor economic areas. You build them in successful economic zones, and the river provided a successful economic zone all the way from Yall up to Cap Gwyn, Lismore, and up to Bride as well to Tallow. And you've dotted along the rivers the various houses as testament to that. The rivers were important for developing that whole area.
Maeve reaches Villierstown, the village of Villierstown grew originally from the important local industry of textile production during the 18th century.
The industry involved the growing of flax by local farmers for linen making, and the traces of the bleaching fields along the banks of the river are still evident from this time. Linen also came to be promoted on Drumannan Estate, and in 1716 the village of Villierstown was built to house the Ulster linen weavers who were brought into the area because of their expertise in flax. And the house that's lived in by Andy Halley today was actually, in fact, known as Bleach House, because the flax would be laid out in the fields to bleach.
The site of Villierstown, prior to it being the town being founded, was known as Drumanna Big. It's also the home of our famous John Tracy, world champion cross country man. But we had a ferry at Villierstown. Until the middle of the last century, cars weren't very plentiful. People crossed the river if they couldn't cross it at Yall Bridge. Their next choice was to go up to Capoquin to cross it. So ferries were pretty important and a mode of transport. And there was a ferry boat and a ferry barge. Now the barge was a chain barge, which a chain was across the bed of the river. And there was a winch on board the ferry which picked up that chain and pulled the boat across. Very similar to the modern method that they have below now at the castle in Waterford. When I grew up in the very early 50s perhaps, I still remember the chain ferry in existence. And the ferry house was over on Villierstown Quay. It's still there. Desmond Hall is living in it. They had that ferry which would bring over animals or horse and cars or anything like that. Or they had a punt about 16 to 18 feet long. And Jimmy Rohan was the ferryman. And if you went down to the sleeping campfire where the ferry moored, Jimmy would see you across and he'd come over for you. It was a very small sum. And I think Jimmy's wages were very small, because when we were searching the book, we found out that he had looked for a rise in wages, and I think he got something like 1 4 pence or something of a rise. And this is in the 40s or 50s.
Fishing has been a way of life on the River Blackwater for centuries. The river was once widely regarded as one of the finest salmon rivers in the country.
The fishing in the river is basically controlled by the Duke of Devonshire and the Villa Stuart. Actually, I think it was the Fitzgerald family that gave the rights, whatever rights were, to the Duke of Devonshire. And they divided up the river between them so that they could fish dragnets on the way down. They also fished snapnets, which involved two boats with two people, and they formed a circle around the fish. And to quote James Villa Stewart, any fella that caught a fish on a snapnet deserved it, because such was the skill required. One of the most famous fishermen on this river, who just died recently, was Noel Lawless. And he fished both snapnets all along this area, and you could see him in the evenings over on the corner there, just that we're off of now. It is there all the boats that collect, and there'd be 7 or 8, maybe more, cats there to go out fishing. All my cousins now as well, the McGraths, George and Bobine and Johnny and Jack and all of them, they all fished along this area and up the Bride there, and they'd have fished snapnets as well.
Mary Kelleher is the daughter of George Hoddles McGrath. For generations, the McGrath family have fished the River Blackwater.
The family fished the Blackwater for over 100 years, and they fished from Drumanna House down to Strandkelly and beyond. There was 20 cots there in the 1940s. There was 2 in each cot, so there was 40 people fishing on that stretch from Drumanna to Strandkelly and beyond. And the fish were really plentiful at the time. And my father said even in the war years, they never went hungry, because they could barter the salmon for bread or whatever else was going if you needed it. Like, that's how they used to work in the war years, when the bread men used to come and you'd only have a certain amount that you could get on the ration book. If he got a salmon, he'd leave more.
Once the fishing season had ended, the fisherman had to look landwards in order to earn a living.
They started cutting spire and cutting scallops and supplying the thatchers. They supplied most of Tipperary, Limerick, near side of Cork, we'll say, and Waterford. It was a good way of making a living, and there was a good social aspect to that too, because it was hard, physical, demanding work, but when it came and you'd be getting paid, it was coming near Christmas when most of those orders would be in, and you'd always have a good Christmas. When I was going through his papers after he died and found all the addresses and the orders from North Tipperary, and it was amazing, all the thatched houses that were there that time that they were supplying. When the Dewadden and the Kathleen and May would come up then, they'd work on the ships. My grandfather Bob and his brother Jack used to guide the Dewadden and the Kathleen and May upriver. My grandfather had such a knowledge of the tides and the silt and that in the river that he knew exactly the times when they could get up and where to navigate on the river up. They'd load on the pit props and load off the coal. And my father remembered horses and carts coming down to the quay to collect the coal and bring it to the various towns, Tallow, Kappoquin, and they'd have what wouldn't be sold for their work. There was no money involved. They'd just get paid by the coal. And my father sometimes then would throw the bike on the Kathleen and me and come back down to y'all and socialise for a little bit and cycle home. It always amazed me that any of the fishermen at that time that I knew of anyway, that they told me about, none of them could swim. Absolutely never learned to swim, and it never bothered them. Like, my uncle didn't know how to swim, as any of them didn't, but he fell overboard one night and he fell into slob up as far as his chest, and they had to call the other cots and the lads had to swap over and try and pull him up out of it. That was the closest call that they had. None of them, thank God, ever drowned, but that was the closest call that they had. The fishing community in Camphor always, whether they were fishing all night or not, when somebody was lost, they always cast out their cots and searched until the bodies were found. They assisted the Gardaí and the Sobapa Club. They'd be out day and night on those days. And I think the longest that I can remember my father telling me somebody was missing for was about 53 days. But I believe they always recovered them. Any fisherman's bereavement or anything, anyone died, the neighbours and their fishermen friends would always dig the grave. There was never any money involved. They'd dig the grave when it was your sad day, and you'd help them when it was theirs. That was always done down in Camphor, up until, I suppose, maybe the 70s, when the older people died out. Like, I think it faded in, but up to then, it was always done. Most of them down there were buried in Knocknoir. It was an understood thing. It was just done for years down there. And they just go ahead and dig the grave, and the people then would only have to pay the undertaker, really, for the coffin. You couldn't make a living off it anymore. But my father made a pretty good living, and he had a good life, and he really enjoyed the river, you know, and even all of his sisters and brothers and all that, when they'd gather, like, they were always saying how through the toughest of times, when things were scarce, they were never hungry, because the river was their livelihood. And my grandfather was known to say, after a few pints, "Forget about the banks. My bank isn't the bank of the River Blackwater."
For 50 years, Mary Sheehan fished the river, first with her father and later with her daughter, on a section of river from Strangkelly to Yall Bridge.
I was just about 14, coming up to 14, I'd say, and I suppose I was the only option. I had been out a little bit during my younger days, you know, and I'd maybe haul the cockle and I'd sit in the stern and be a passenger with whatever crew my father would have. And it turned out to be a good season, and I kind of got addicted to it. It wasn't an easy life for a woman, and I suppose it was unique for a girl to be fishing in those days, back to the early 50s. Just because I was a woman didn't mean that we had an easy time. I was able to pull the oars and haul the nets and gained a lot of knowledge from my father as to where the exact spots to pay out our nets for drifting and how to read the tides so that our nets wouldn't get caught in rocks. And it's a skill in itself, an art in itself, and it takes a good few years to learn it. It gave a lot of men employment for about 6 months of the year. It started on the 1st of February and ended on the 31st of July, the salmon season. You would fish about 3.5 to 4 hours before low water. And you would fish down for about 3.5 to 4 hours. At low water then, all the fishermen would go in at designated little spots, have their lunch, and then they take their turn and fish back up with the tide. We had to have a license from the Duke of Devonshire. This river, it's a privately owned river, owned by the Duke of Devonshire. We had to pay a license to the Duke to fish, and we had to also pay a conservator's license too, in order to sell the fish. It was passed down from generation to generation, my grandfather to my father being Richard Morrison, and his father being Richard Morrison as well, and later on to myself and my husband John. You had a designated spot. Our numbers were U42. That meant upper. Upper licenses were from the bridge up to Old Strangkelly Castle, which was the designated area that we could fish from. You know, we drift down with the tide, we'll say, and back up again. But the lower licences then had to have an L on their boards, like lower 20, and you also had to have your name on the boat, the name of the licence holder. All the old spots, of course, had Irish names on them, you know, like Point D'Aquila and Lying the Soggart and the Corrigwaun and Corrignagower, and all the old names now, you know, they're all forgotten, I suppose.
Many families along the river were completely self-sufficient.
They all had a little bit of land. They grew their own potatoes. They all had maybe a donkey or a pony and a couple of sheep maybe. They had 5 or 6 acres. And they had hens and ducks and geese maybe and turkeys. After July then, some of the men would get a job with the local farmers. Maybe the threshing season, the harvest would be coming in. And then that would keep them going up to Christmas. And maybe at Christmas then the wives would, they'd have eggs to sell and they'd have turkeys to sell and maybe geese to sell. And if they had sheep, they would shear the sheep. I remember coming down to Yall here in the boats with the fleece of the sheep, and we'd sell it to a shop called Broderick's. And my mother would buy, you know, our shoes for the winter, and she'd always get one of those lovely dripsy blankets, wool blankets and stuff like that. And, you know, they managed to weigh fine like that. It was a simple life, I suppose. My daughter took up the fishing with me, and I finished the fishing, I suppose, in the last year of the fishing, whatever year that was. We were the only all-female crew, and we did that for a good many years, my daughter Siobhan and myself. There was a man came over from England just to visit her. His parents are from Yall based, and he was so happy to be out in the boat with us that he wrote a song about it, in fact. Yeah, it's called Drifting on the Old Blackwater, and this means happy days to me. I suppose he was asking me about it, and I said, well, it means a lot of happiness. Happiness out in lovely fine weather, my children with me. It was a great, great industry, and I'm very sad that it has gone. It's part of our heritage, and gone, forgotten. When I see on the quays, like the old salmon yawls, and they're just thrown, they're rotting on the quays, and the quays all covered in weeds, and I feel sad that that part of our heritage has gone, forgotten.
The crew's final port of call for this part of their journey is Campfire House and Castle. Campfire House originally belonged to the Usher family, having been built by Captain John Usher, a veteran of the Battle of Blenheim in 1704.
There's no actually sign of Campfire Castle. It is just the outline of a ruin of what was once a fortification is still to be seen, but the main building that we see here is Campfire House. This house actually replaced an earlier house, an Elizabethan house, which was built further back from the river. And this house, again, it is a Georgian house. And it belonged originally to the Usher family. It was built by Captain John Usher, a veteran of the 1704 Battle of Blenheim, whose son, St. George Usher St. George, succeeded him as MP for Carrick and Shannon, and he was created the first Baron St. George of Hatley St. George in County Roscommon in 1763, but he died in Naples in 1775. And then it became the home of the Dobbs family. Sir Henry Conway Dobbs was governor of Ceylon, and when he retired, he came and lived at Campfire, and he's buried actually in the graveyard at Fountain. And it was lived in then by his descendants, and the last descendant of him was Susan Dobbs, who lived there until very recently. She died just a couple of years ago, and she's also buried over at a fountain.
There is a record of in 1880 Usher's yacht being crushed by ice here on the Blackwater, and there's a letter from their agent to them outside in India, wherever they were at the time, telling them that one could walk across the Blackwater from Killehale to Dromana. Now, this year we've seen the ice in the Blackwater, we got some photographs of it, and we can well imagine that the same thing could happen again. I think it was in the 1300s or 1400s, the lady living there, the chieftain's wife, got boats and came upriver to Dromana House with 800 troops and laid siege to it and captured it and held it for a day or two until the Fitzgeralds agreed to her demands.
Next week, in the final episode of Blackwater Life and Lodgings, the crew embark on the final leg of their journey, visiting Dromana on their way to Capoquin. Blackwater Life and Lodgings was produced by Noel Cronin, narrated by Mervyn Scott, researched by Angela Kearns, and edited by Sean Healy.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.